At each of his five stops in Alabama, Roosevelt made brief speeches and was greeted by large crowds. Jim Haggerty, the usually hard-boiled New York Times reporter who later became Dwight Eisenhower's press secretary, wrote, "At every stop, the sea of faces turned upward, gazing at him with the hope that he would be the Moses to lead the American people out of the wilderness of the economic depression. Mingled with the applause, there could be felt, rather than heard, a note of trust that he would be able to bring back the happy days promised in his campaign song." The planning continued at Warm Springs, punctuated by numerous visitors and a public celebration of Roosevelt's 51st birthday, attended by 150 patients and staff members of the Warm Springs Foundation. Docking in Miami after an 11-day fishing cruise on Vincent Astor's yacht Normahal on February 15th, Roosevelt was driven in an open car to Bayfront Park in downtown Miami, where thousands of people were waiting to see him. His bodyguard, Gus Genrich, 1887 to 1936, adeptly boosted him into a sitting position atop the back of the open car, and he spoke briefly, seven sentences, telling the crowd that he was no stranger, having been in Miami several times and had a wonderful time. Moments later, five shots rang out, as Giuseppe Zangara, 32, a naturalized Italian-American, attempted to kill Roosevelt. He was standing on a bench, two or three dozen feet away, and opened fire with a cheap .32 caliber revolver bought in a Miami pawn shop 2 days before. Impeded by a brave woman who grabbed his arm and hung on, he missed Roosevelt, who by this time had slid back down to the car seat, but did hit five others, two of them Chicago Mayor Anton Cermak, who had briefly shaken Roosevelt's hand just after the talk, was walking away from the car, and Mrs. Jo H. Gill, wife of the president of a local utility, were in critical condition. Cermak would eventually die. Roosevelt himself was the epitome of cool. A telegram of thanks he sent to the woman who may have saved his life included the following passage. "It now appears that by divine providence the lives of all the victims of the assassin's disturbed aim will be spared." If he believed that, and there was every reason to think that he did, he must also have believed that God had spared him. He gave his own account to reporters the next morning. "After I had finished speaking, I slid off the back of the car into my seat. Just then Mayor Cermak came forward. I shook hands and talked to him for nearly a minute. Then he moved off around the back of the car. Bob Clark, one of the Secret Service men, was standing right beside him to the right. As he moved off, a man came forward. While he was talking to me, I was leaning forward toward the left side of the car. Just then I heard what I thought was a firecracker. Then several more. The man talking to me was pulled back and the chauffeur started the car. I looked around and saw Mayor Cermak doubled up and Mrs. Gill collapsing. Mrs. Gill was at the foot of the bandstand steps. I called to the chauffeur to stop. He did, about 15 feet from where we started. The Secret Service men shouted at him to get out of the crowd and he started forward again. I stopped him a second time, this time at the corner of the bandstand, about 30 feet on. I saw Mayor Cermak being carried. I motioned to have him put in the back seat of the car, which would be the first out." Roosevelt held Cermak all the way to the hospital, telling him at one point, "Tony, keep quiet. Don't move. It won't hurt if you keep quiet."